of testing quantum theory experimentally in a fairly sort of systematic way, based on some ideas that have sort of been floating around in quantum foundations in sort of on the theory side for a while now. Those ideas generally sort of come under the heading of generalized probabilistic theories or something like that. On the theory side, people have done a bunch of sort of things with this idea. So the idea is you sort of set up a framework that's very general. It includes quantum theory, classical probability theory, other kind of crazier theories as well. And you just sort of have this mathematical framework that puts them all on the same footing and allows you to compare them. And so one thing people have done with that is they've sort of compared how much power these different theories have for various tasks. Sort of you might wonder whether quantum theory is the most powerful theory or whether there are other theories that would allow you to build fast computers or whatever. Another thing that's been very prominent is sort of just starting with this basic framework and then saying, well, what extra axioms do I need to add in order to actually narrow us down to quantum theory? Okay, and the idea is that this gives you a kind of better explanation of where the sort of principles of quantum theory you see in your textbook come from, because you can make these axioms have a very sort of physical or operational flavor. So here's two different papers that use two different sets of axioms, and both of them get you down to quantum theory. So I'm going to introduce the framework a bit more in a minute. One thing you notice if you look at any of these papers, for example, is that even though they're all written by theorists and there's no experiments in any of them, they all try and take a very sort of operational approach. So they say, okay, we're going to have these preparation devices, we're going to have measurement devices, we're going to look at the probabilities, and the whole framework is kind of set up in those terms. And what that means, hopefully, if all these people weren't kidding themselves, is that you should be able to use actual preparation devices and actual measurement devices. You should be able to get some actual probabilities and do everything they say with real data. And that's what we've tried to do in our experiment. Okay, so let me just sort of give you a bit more details about the framework. So the kind of central object in these theories are just probabilities, okay? So you imagine you have some system and you have a bunch of ways you can prepare that system. So I'm calling that sort of preparation I, say. And then you have a bunch of ways you can measure it. So maybe you're doing measurement number J. And then that measurement gives some outcomes. I'm labeling those with K. And the theory, the sort of main purpose of the theory is just to tell you the probability of getting a particular outcome when you do a particular measurement on a particular preparation. Okay? So in a way, you can think of this entire theory as just being a huge table of all of these probabilities for, still a typo in here, for all of these preparations and all of these different measurements. Okay? And for sort of technical reasons, it's useful to just have a bunch of ones here to show that these preparations are normalized. Okay? So you can think of that as just being the probability of the trivial measurement that always happens. Okay, so I mean, if this was all the theory was, just a huge table of probabilities, you know, there might be thousands of preparations or measurements you can do. There might even be an infinite number of preparations and measurements you can do. So this would be a pretty unwieldy theory. And so the next idea in this framework is that you'll often notice that this matrix is actually quite low rank. And in particular, if you fix your system of interest, you might find that even as you increase the number of preparations and measurements, so you're making this big matrix even bigger and bigger, it stays at some fixed rank. So the simplest example would be if you have a qubit, and quantum theory is exactly true, you would find that this matrix was rank 4 no matter how many preparations and measurements you added to it. Okay, so What that means, if you have an n by m matrix that's rank 4, that means you can factorize it into an n by 4 and a 4 by m matrix. And then you can think of those matrices as just having a row. The first matrix is having a row for each preparation, and the second matrix is having a column for each measurement. And then the fact that this matrix only has 4 columns means that you only need 4 parameters to specify the preparation. And since one of those parameters is just keeping track of this normalization business, you actually only need 3 non-trivial parameters for each preparation. Okay? And you know, this should be starting to sound pretty familiar at this point. You need 4 real parameters to specify each measurement. And then, you know, since this is just matrix multiplication, if I want to know the probability of this measurement on this preparation, I'm just going to take the dot product of this vector with this vector. Okay? And that's basically the essence of the framework. You just put all your probabilities in a big table. You notice that it's low rank, so you choose a factorization like this. And then you think of these vectors as representing the preparations, these vectors as representing the measurements, and you get the probabilities back by just doing the dot product of those vectors. Okay, so that was all a little bit abstract. It's useful to kind of see how this all works in a case you're all familiar with. So as you know, in quantum theory, you represent a preparation procedure by a density operator and an outcome of a measurement by a PAVM element. And then you get this vector by just taking the trace of that density operator with Pauli matrices. Okay, so these three numbers here are just the components of the standard block vector. Okay, and on the measurement side, you do a very similar thing. And this is kind of like a block vector for measurement outcomes, except now you have to keep track of this component as well that just tells you the trace of the PAVM element. Okay. And then once you've done this, in general, you'll find that you can't just get any old vector here, and you can't just get any old vector here, but rather there's some sort of non-trivial structure in the set of those things. And in the case of quantum theory, you all know what that structure is. The block vectors have to live inside a unit sphere. What's maybe slightly less known is that you can express the positivity condition for qubit effects by this sort of strange-looking condition, which, because it's got 4 components, I can't really draw. But if you just ignore one of these components, say this one, then what you get in 3D is a cone like this. Okay, so the full shape is really some shape in some kind of cone like this in 4D with the block sphere in the middle here. Okay, so that's all the theory stuff. And the basic idea of our experiment is we're going to have some system we think is a qubit. We're going to do a bunch of preparations and measurements, and then we're going to follow this whole procedure and see what sort of shapes we come up with. Okay. If you try and do that, you'll hit a wrinkle immediately, which is that you know, you're going to, let's say you do 100 preparations and 100 measurements of your qubit, and you put those all in a big matrix, 100 by 100 matrix. Well, each of those entries is not the actual probability. It's an estimate you've made of that probability from the relative frequencies you observed in your experiment. And so each of those estimates has its own error on it, which means that even if the matrix of true probabilities had rank 4, your matrix of estimated probabilities is going to be full rank. Okay? And so you can illustrate that with a very trivial example, which is imagine you had a bunch of 2D points, and theoretically they should come from a rank 1 matrix, which means they're just all proportional to each other. Because of your statistical errors, they're not going to be quite proportional to each other. But then, you know, this is just something fairly standard. When you have a bunch of points, you expect to be on a line, and they're not quite on a line because of statistical errors. Then you come up with a line of best fit, and you use that as your kind of model of what the data is. Okay? And so all we do is a higher dimensional version of this fairly sort of mundane analysis. And you know, the figure of merit is just the sort of average deviations of your fitted points from the actual points you measured, which ends up being something like this. And the important thing is we're going to put a rank constraint on it because we want to find one of these low rank models. Okay, that's the equivalent of saying, in the simple example, that the points have to be on a line. Okay, I think that's time for
Mike. How do you know what rank to pick?
Mike will answer that question.
Yeah. That's what I'm just about to talk about. Yeah, okay, so we just need to swap the microphone first.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, so hi, I should introduce myself. I'm Mike Mazurek. I'm a PhD student in Kevin Rush's group at IQC at the University of Waterloo. So now I'm going to talk about the experiment that we did to test these ideas and some of the things that we calculated. I'll get to your question about the rank in a second, but first I'm just going to talk about the experimental setup that we used. So in our experiment, we prepared a whole bunch of different polarization states on single photons and did a whole bunch of different measurements on those polarization states. So this is the setup that we used. We used a Sagnac spontaneous parametric downconversion source to create photon pairs. For experimentalists in the room, often this type of photon source is used to create entangled photon pairs. We created photon pairs that were separable in the polarization. So we really just use this as a heralded single photon source. And so, you know, if we heralded one of the photons, then we knew that there was another one in this arm of the experiment. And this is the one that we performed our preparations and measurements on. So, you know, just kind of standard polarization optics. We used a couple of wave plates to rotate polarization and set the state of our photon, and then two wave plates and a polarizing beam splitter to perform a two outcome measurement on that polarization state. One thing that I'd like to point out is this single mode fiber that we have between the preparation and measurement stage of the experiment. And what that was used for was basically as a spatial filter. So we used it to prevent, you know, additional degrees of freedom, spatial degrees of freedom by being introduced into the preparation state of the photon. As you rotate the wave plates, you know, they're not perfect and they deflect the beam a little bit. So we just, this filter removed that information. So that was an effort to have only the polarization of the photon contain information about the preparation procedure that we chose. So here is our big matrix of raw data. We performed 100 different measurements on 100 different preparations. So this is a plot, a matrix plot of the probabilities that we measured. All of these numbers are between 0 and 1. And then each column of this matrix represents a different measurement, and every row represents a different preparation. Because of the order that we chose to perform the preparations and measurements in, we kind of end up with this nice looking pattern. But that's just an artifact of the order that we chose to perform these things in. Okay, so about this question about what rank of model should we choose. So we would expect, you know, because we all believe in quantum theory, that, you know, probably we want to fit to a rank 4 model. But we wanted to test other models and see, you know, what the best one really was. So this plot here, the blue lines, or the blue dots, are the chi-squared value, goodness of fit metric that we measured for a bunch of different model ranks between 2 and 10. And this red line is you know, the chi-squared value that you would expect to get, you know, if you're fitting, if you chose the appropriate rank model. So you can see here that, you know, rank 2 and 3 models do very poorly. They're very far off of what you would expect. You know, rank 4 starts to do okay, and then you start to get a bit of a separation when you go to higher rank models. The second plot, it's the same information from this one, but now I've plotted the p-value instead of the chi-squared value. The p-value is, I like to think of it as kind of a normalized measure of the distance between, you know, just these blue and red lines. For a perfect fit, or a good fit, you should get a p-value of somewhere around 50%, which we see for the rank 4 model. And then these other p-values are further away. So this is some evidence that maybe rank 4 is the best model that we want to fit to. But it's not. I'm not entirely convinced by this that, you know, a rank 5 model isn't, you know, just as good. So to kind of distinguish between the rank 4, 5, and 6 models, we wanted to test the predictive power of these models. So if a model is, you know, overfitting the data, you would expect it to have predictive power that's not as good as a model that's not overfitting the data or fits the data well. So what we did is we held back most of the data that we took. We just kept 6 measurements and 6 preparations. And then we, you know, performed a fit, chose a GPT fit, you know, with this data, and then we used that model to predict, you know, everything else in this empty square. So we did that for these 3 different model ranks. And then this number here on the right is the root mean squared error between the model's predicted probabilities and the actual probabilities that we measured. So the root mean squared error is lowest for a model of rank 4. So we're going to assume that rank 4 is indeed the best model for this data. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to use this rank 4 model. And all of the results that I'm going to talk about from now on are calculated using this rank 4 fitted GPT.
Yeah. So when you say the best model for that data, I want to make sure I'm understanding right, that it's not necessarily the best model for the state. It's the best model for the state given the limited data you have, right? Because as you took more data, suppose it's really full rank, right, but different elements are smaller and smaller. So it looks low rank to the best of your ability to estimate any of the matrix elements. But as you take more data, you'll reveal more of those small elements. So when you use a subset, you're actually probably going to underestimate the rank even further, don't you think?
So you're right that if we were to take more and more data, you know, just count more and more photons, at some point we would, well, I expect that we would find that the, you know, the true probabilities are more than rank 4. And the reason for that is there are always going to be, like, you know, some systematic errors in the experiment. And as you take more data, the size of those systematic errors won't grow, but the size of the probabilistic error will, you know, decrease and reveal itself.
If there were an error, it's just, you know, there is some smallest element. And if you take sufficiently little data, your statistical errors will eventually be larger than that smallest element.
Yeah.
So it seems to me in that case, you'll always just converge on a rank that ignores that, and that the rank in that sense is dependent on how much data you have.
Yeah, I think you're right. You are right, I agree. Yes?
The estimation that you're doing, it depends on these two norms. You're choosing the two norms, as far as I can tell, between the what you're measuring and what should be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason why you're choosing this norm? It seems to me that the analysis depends on this norm too.
Well, that's, you know, the standard definition of the chi-squared statistic. And so since we're using a chi-square test to quantify the quality of the fit, that's the reason for that choice. Yeah. And it's not quite the two norm between the fitted and the raw data. It's a weighted two norm because, you know, different points in this data are going to have different error bars. So we weighed it appropriately to take those into account. So now that we have this nice fitted GPT, well, so we have, we took our matrix of raw data, you know, and found this fitted matrix with the theory, but as Matt said before, we expect that this M by N matrix should be decomposable into something simpler, namely these two, this preparation and this, the measurement effect matrix, which are size M by the rank. In this case, the rank is 4. So there isn't a unique solution to this equation in general. So we have to choose a decomposition. And we choose to use the singular value decomposition. Just for those who may be unfamiliar with it, U and V are two unitary matrices, and the sigma is a matrix of singular values. Because of the definition of this, or the way this decomposition is defined, it ensures that the only non-zero entries in this singular value matrix will be in the upper left, R by R corner of this matrix. So then we can, you know, decompose, well, we choose to decompose in this way. So this, you know, U times root sigma is the appropriate size. And so P and M are both, you know, M by 4 and or 4 by N matrices. I should say that this isn't entirely the whole story of the decomposition that we chose. We modified this a little bit to add the constraint that the first column of the P matrix had to be all ones, as Matt mentioned that we could do, that contains the normalization of the state. And the reason that we chose that is so that we could now you know, plot our state space in 3 dimensions instead of 4. So this is the space of states that we reconstructed from this GPT of best fit. And you can see you get something that looks kind of like a Bloch sphere. It's not perfectly smooth because we've only done a finite number of preparations. And we can also plot the effect space. So here on the left, I've plotted that cone that we might expect to see if we assume quantum mechanics is true, which a lot of us might. and then this is another 3-dimensional projection of the same data. So that's the sphere in the center of this 4-dimensional cone. So now, this isn't all that we can calculate with this model. So I want to talk about the dual spaces that we can calculate as well. So we've measured the state space and reconstructed it. But you know, there's no reason to believe that this contains all of the possible states that we could have, or all of the possible preparations that we could have performed in the lab. And the reason is that, you know, because there's some noise in our experiment, so that's going to bring states closer to the center of the state space. And also, we've only performed a finite number of them. But you can calculate something called the dual of the measurement effect space. And that's going to contain every logically valid state vector. And what I mean by logically valid is there's, given the effect space that we have, there's some set of state vectors which when dotted with with anything in the measurement space will give you a valid probability, so some number between 0 and 1. So we can calculate the dual of the effect space. It looks now something like the state space, with a slightly different shape. And it's, you know, by definition, going to be a little bit bigger than the state space that we prepared. So this wireframe here is the dual of the effect space. And then this orange ball in the center is the state space that we measured. So you can see that there's some, you know, gap between these two spaces. But since we've measured these two spaces, we know that the true state space has to lie somewhere in between these two, like somewhere within this gap. Okay, so now that we've done this, we thought, well, what if we did an experiment where we took a lot more data? It's maybe kind of hard to see, but there is a tiny sliver of data up at the top and down on the left side here. And what we did is we chose 6 measurements, and we measured 1,000 states each with each of those measurements. So that would be these 6 columns of data on the left. And then we also chose 1,000 preparations, and we performed 6 measurements on each of those preparations. And then we could perform this a fit using this data. And if we fit that model, it will predict you know, all of the probabilities for, you know, any preparation measurement pair that you might think. The reason that we, you know, only measured this small subset of data, because this is 12,000 measurement preparation pairs. If we wanted to do all these measurements, it would be a million, which would have taken way too long. So now we can recreate the state space, and we get a, you know, another block-like sphere, and it's a lot smoother than what we had for the 100 by 100 data. We can calculate the dual of the effect space, and now it's the gap between these two spaces is a lot smaller. I'm going to try and zoom in, and you can maybe see that, you know, there is still a little bit of a gap between these two spaces. So we wanted to quantify the size of the gap between the state and dual effect space. As I just mentioned, our GPT of best fit isn't quite self-dual. The true state space is somewhere in between the two spaces that I just showed you. So just to put a rough metric on it, we thought we'd compare the four-dimensional volumes of these spaces. So for the 100 by 100 data, the first data that I showed, the volume of the preparation space, the ratio of the preparation space's volume to the effect space volume is, you know, about 91%. For this, when we take more data, we're able to get a slightly higher ratio of the two volumes. So this kind of gives us a rough idea of how much we've constrained the area that the true state space could live in. And you can calculate these same things for the, you know, the size of the effect space, and you get very similar numbers as are up here. So this data really kind of experimentally constrains where all of the states and measurements could live. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the, well, give an example of one of the types of things that you could, you know, hope to calculate given this information. And what that's going to be is the maximal violation you can get of the CHSH inequality. So just to remind everyone of the CHSH scenario, you have, you know, two parties, Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob each have a choice of two measurement settings, which I've labeled by X for Alice and Y for Bob. And they both have two measurement outcomes, A for Alice, B for Bob. This equation down here is the CHSH inequality. It's written in a form that I'm not as used to. I'm used to seeing a sum of four expectation values instead of a form of, you know, four probabilities. But it is the same CHSH inequality. So the logical upper bound for this sum of probabilities on the left is one. The bound for a local hidden variable model is 3/4. And the, you know, upper bound, if you assume quantum theory, is this 2 plus root 2 over 4, which is about 85%. Okay, so you might be thinking, wait, how are you testing a CHSH inequality? Isn't this an experiment on only a single particle? The answer is yes, but that's okay. So what we assume is that in Alice's lab, she performs some measurements and gets some outcomes, and she has four possible options for a measurement choice plus outcome pair. And then for each of those pairs, we assume that Alice steers Bob's state to somewhere inside the state space that we did measure. So the state spaces that we measured and the state and effect spaces we measured, we'll assume that those apply to Bob's lab. For Alice, we don't assume anything about what she can measure. We just assume that she has, you know, different probabilities of getting different measurement outcomes. If Alice, you know, chooses measurement 0 and gets outcome 0, then maybe it steers Bob's state to somewhere up here. If she gets outcome 1, you know, maybe it steers Bob's state to somewhere down here at the bottom of the sphere. We're going to add the additional constraint that we aren't going to allow any signaling between Alice and Bob. And all that means is that the choice of Alice's measurement can't give Bob any information. For any pair of measurement outcomes, when you weight those equal with the probability of Alice, you know, getting each of these outcomes, you'll get some state in the center of the sphere. And then that equally weighted mixture has to be the same, regardless of what measurement Alice chooses. So then there's nothing that Bob could possibly do to distinguish between Alice's measurement bases. Okay, so then under these constraints, what we're going to do is, you know, look for states and measurements in Bob's lab that Bob could perform. So states that Bob could be steered to and measurements that Bob could perform on those states, which violate the CHSH inequality. And just an important point that when we're searching for these states and measurements, we're going to be looking inside the dual spaces because that gives the, you know, the maximum upper bound on states and measurements that Bob could be performing. So just roughly the way that we did this calculation is we started by just choosing two extremal effects from Bob's dual state space, or maximum possible effect space. And then given those two effects, we're going to do an optimization over all of the states that Bob could be steered to. So, you know, we'll do some optimization varying out these four states that Bob could be steered to, and look for the states that give the maximal violation of the inequality. This optimization can be solved with a linear program, so it's, you know, simple to set up and convex and has all the nice properties of an optimization. And then we're going to do this optimization for every pair of extremal effects that we could have possibly chosen for Bob. And then we just keep the maximum violation. So we did this for our GPT, a best fit for the 100 by 100 data. We found this number. So the maximal kind of violation that you could expect to get with the state spaces we measured is, you know, about 0.87, which is, you know, slightly larger than the quantum mechanical upper bound. And that's not so surprising because we're searching for states and effects in the extremal, like in the dual state and effect spaces, which are a little bit bigger than the corresponding quantum spaces. I should mention that this number should be taken with a maybe large grain of salt. We tried to perform a Monte Carlo analysis to get this error bar. So I think we simulated a, you know, 100 different possible models just by varying, assuming Poissonian noise on our raw data, and then performed this optimization. This number is only taken from four of those Monte Carlo samples. So it's a small sample size, but, you know, the variation in those four samples is still quite small. So we're working on, you know, continuing that or completing this calculation. But that's what we have so far. Okay, so just in conclusion, I think that the work that we did in some sense is helping to bridge the gap between theory and experiment. And what I mean by that is, so we now have a tool to take experiments and interpret them in the language of GPTs or generalized probabilistic theories, instead of, you know, having to assume quantum mechanics to fit your states and measurements and to figure out what they are. So now we can kind of characterize these things in a more general framework. And so if a theorist has some idea for some property of quantum mechanics or some other theory that they want to test, if they can just phrase that idea in the language of GPTs, then this kind of gives a, you know, one possible way that an experimentalist could go in the lab and you measure the appropriate GPT state and effect spaces and then use that data to test this theoretical idea. And maybe a slightly more technical note, the tomography that we've done in this experiment uses fewer assumptions than you traditionally might see in quantum state or measurement tomography. So with quantum state tomography, a common assumption that's made that the measurements that are performed are very well characterized. In quantum measurement tomography, you often might assume that the states that you're sending into the measurements are very well characterized. We didn't have to make that assumption in the analysis that we did here. We kind of treated errors on the states and measurements equally, and we're still able to find, you know, characterize these states and measurements. You know, they're with some amount of error, but it treats the errors on a more equal footing. Yeah. So like to talk a bit about, you know, some possible future directions that we could go with this. The first is to look at the full space of POVMs. So we've fully characterized the effect space, but not every POVM that you could, or measurement that you could dream up, could be performed as a convex combination of the measurements that we performed in this experiment. So as an example, so every measurement that we performed had two outcomes. Yeah, you can imagine a three-outcome POVM, which would lie, you know, somewhere else. It would use effects from somewhere else in the effect space that we measured. So these wouldn't introduce any additional effects, but the measurements in the full measurement space might look a little bit different. So we could look at, you know, measurements with more than two outcomes. Another thing, so we've characterized these GPT states and effects. The third thing that you might jump to thinking of is, well, what about the GPT transformations that are allowed? Maybe there's something to characterize the full space of allowed transformations. And this could maybe have, this is kind of an analogy to performing quantum process tomography, for example. Of course, we could look into higher dimensions, especially if you want to use these things to test theoretical ideas or, you know, different features of different theories. Some features in of quantum mechanics don't appear for qubits, but they do appear for qutrits or higher. And it would be nice to look into, you know, how we treated the errors in this data. So the fit that we did was really a maximum likelihood tomography fit. It would be good. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head how to do it, but it would be nice maybe to be able to, you know, define a confidence region for the position of states or effects in the measurement. And of course, I mean, I really like photons, but you could try applying these ideas to other types of systems. Okay, so that's where my presentation ends. I'd like to invite Matt back up here so we can answer some questions.
So maybe the best thing is if you unclip the mic and then you can just share it back and forth.
Okay.
So questions, we have lots of time. Steve.
I was thinking if you did that same experiment but started off lazy and tried to do fewer preparations and measurements, and without really thinking about it, you ended up just doing preparations and measurements that corresponded to compass points on the Bloch sphere, like you're doing all things involving qubit stabilizers, then it seems to me most of the analysis would follow along. You'd still conclude that you probably want to use rank 4, but you'd end up constructing a state and measurement space, which is like, you know, an octahedron inside the Bloch sphere, which has a different interpretation in quantum mechanics. So is there anything that would sort of flag in terms of a principle that I should go back to the lab and do more measurements if I really want to explore this system? Like you sort of hinted that, I'd reconstruct the state space and I'd see if it's a qubit that it is a sphere. I mean, do you want something to do with constructing state spaces of particular forms? Does that make any sense?
So I think in answering this question, this is where these jewels are very useful. So if you only prepared and measured stabilizer states and measurements, then you would get that octahedron for the state space, but the jewel of your effect space would be like a huge cube around that. And so you would look at that and you would say, well, I know that the true state space is somewhere between that octahedron and that cube, but, you know, that's kind of unsatisfying. Like, I'd like to know a bit more detail about the state space. And, you know, if you wanted to calculate any numbers using that, it would have all of that freedom to go anywhere from that octahedron to that cube, so you'd get very kind of weak bounds. And that's what we're trying to quantify with this volume thing, is how good a job have you done of really narrowing down the state space to like a small region.
it seems to me that still makes an assumption that you know how many dimensions you have, right? If you were just working in the equatorial plane and didn't even realize there was another phase, this would never tell you that. Essentially, your dual would just be infinitely large in this dimension you're unaware of, right? Okay.
A project I tried to do many years ago and made no progress on whatsoever is sort of the following. There's all these results of deriving quantum theory from sets of reasonable axioms. And one can imagine a similar project where instead you tried to show that you had a sufficient set of experimental facts to get quantum theory. You know, so some set of experiments should go out, and then given that those experiments turned out a certain way, you'd be able to derive quantum theory. Now, probably that couldn't actually work because you could always have a case where quantum theory breaks down once you get above a certain size system. But maybe some set of experimental facts plus still one or two theoretical principles might be sufficient to derive quantum theory. So then the question is, what would be those experimental facts, and how would you go about isolating? So you can imagine trying to perform experiments that would test the theoretical axioms in some set. Or perhaps one could take a different approach. But in any case, I wonder if you have any ideas on it.
I'll attempt to give you an answer. I'll give that answer in terms of the experimental facts that we now have. Again, modulo this assumption about the true number of degrees of freedom, the true rank of the matrix that we have. We have evidence that it's four, but as you pointed out, it is still an assumption that we're making. So we have characterized, pretty closely the polarization state of a single photon is. So I'll call that a qubit. I think that just given these spaces that we characterized, you get a lot of the same features from quantum theory out. It doesn't give you a theory that's exactly equal to quantum theory. One of the things that we want to check is, does quantum theory truly agree with, or could it agree with the data that we have? And one way to check that would just be to see if you can draw a sphere between the state and the dual effect space.
That's
I don't know if that's what you were getting at.
You need to go to more systems and high dimensions and so on.
And
more general maps and all this kind of thing to get all the quantum theory. So obviously you could never do all the experiments that quantum theory that are possible, but with some kind of scaling principle in addition to some large set of experiments of facts, you might be able to. But this certainly is a step in this direction.
Maybe it's worth saying something about our attempts to look at the axiom of their existing continuous reversible transformations among states. Being bound on deviations from that.
Maybe firstly I could just rephrase your question slightly like this. You have this landscape of generalized probabilistic theories, and then the approach before this has been to use theoretical principles to narrow you down to quantum theory.
Right.
And our approach here is to not really adopt any theoretical principles other than the framework itself, and then see how far experimental data can narrow you down.
Yep.
But there should be a whole spectrum of possibilities between those two extremes, where you take some kind of input from experiment and use a certain amount of sort of theoretical principles.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe in the end, those would give you the most compelling reconstructions if you could really make sure your theoretical principles are kind of very natural looking.
Yeah.
And then you just add in a little sort of sea of experimental data and then go back quantum theory. One thing we did try doing is once you have these state spaces, you can start to just ask pretty much any question about that state space. So we thought a bit about, let's just look at some of these principles that people have used in reconstructions and see if they're consistent with this data, right? So one of the principles that's often used is that there are reversible transformations between every pair of pure states, for example. And so we could try and study our state space and see if that's compatible with what we have, for example.
Did you actually do some analysis on that?
It's kind of, or at least we found it difficult to sort of figure out exactly what the right figure of merit is and how to do the analysis and stuff. But in principle, it should be possible.
Sure. So like you picked a pretty simple space to work with, and I think it's really cool how you can find the sphere. But what if like you threw something in that you didn't understand quite as well, and you started off with a state space that you didn't know what it was supposed to look like? That would be a more convincing kind of experiment in a way, because then you could say, oh, like we've actually discovered either some way of using our system or what space our system works in. I'm just thinking like in the context of your experiment, some ways you built it to be in this state space to start off with. So for instance, like as an experimental detail, you probably picked wave plates that work for the whole bandwidth of your light. Whereas somebody who's ignorant of how to do optics might not do that, so they might pick a narrow band wave plate. I'm just curious, like what would you end up seeing for your state space?
Well, so I think the first thing that you would see if you were to have these additional degrees of freedom in your experiment is when you first tried to fit a model to your data, you would find that, you know, rank four or the qubit model wasn't the best fit. Your data would have more degrees of freedom or more parameters required to quantify it than you would expect. So I think the very first step is you'd fit a model of a different rank. And then once you recreated the state and effect spaces, from there you would get something that looked, you know, it's going to be in a different dimension, so it's going to look totally different from a sphere, I assume. And I mean, that would definitely be your clue that your experiment isn't giving you what you were expecting to see. And I mean, that is when we were performing this experiment, that was something that we had to kind of work hard to do to remove the systematic types of error that were introducing additional degrees of freedom. I mean, that's the first thing you would see. I don't know what that would tell you after that, just that you have a system with more, that's able to carry more information, I guess, than you initially thought it would be able to.
So I think it's kind of interesting that you actually worked backwards, right? Like you knew what you wanted to end up with, and then you tailored your experiment to, I mean, I know that's what we often do in experiments, but I just mean, given that you're supposed to be starting this kind of blind, I think it's kind of interesting that that's true, because you could almost look at that as an experimental design technique or something.
Yeah, and I agree that, I mean, looking at more complex experiments and, you know, maybe doing a lazier job at setting up the experiment. It's possible that you could see some interesting things, for sure. Yeah.
Another way to put it, I think, is that we can't claim that we just went to the lab and discovered quantum theory. But I think what we could fairly convincingly argue is that this framework allows somebody who does know quantum theory to convince somebody who doesn't know quantum theory that this system is described by this sort of state space that looks roughly like a sphere. So if you can teach this person the generalized probabilistic theory framework, then you can use your knowledge of quantum theory to build the experiment and collect the data, and then hopefully they can do the analysis and be convinced that this really is a good description of this system.
Maybe if I can add one other thing, which is
sorry. I'm getting two answers at once.
I was just going to add that one thing that's nice about the dual space business is that if you happen to be living in a world which has this self-duality property, the state space and the dual effect space coincide, then that's a kind of natural stopping point. Like so if you've got a big gap between those spaces, you might say, well, maybe I just haven't done enough preparations and measurements. Let me see and go do some more. And then if you close that gap, and if you get to a point where there's not much gap, then you really know that you've narrowed in on what the actual state space is. Sorry, there's a question over here.
So more of a technical question on the dual of the effect space. Like, I didn't quite understand one of the requirements. You said like logically logically plausible states or something, which I thought that would be like probability one type normalization. But then you talked about this cube that would be bigger than the sphere. So can you like help me a little bit more with the intuition of getting the dual and comparing that with the instances?
So we do this, we collect this data, and then we factorize it into these matrices. And those give us vectors associated with each of the preparations that we actually did, and vectors associated with each of the measurements that we actually did. And when you take the dot product of those, you get some vector, you get some probability between 0 and 1. But what you'll usually find is that there are other vectors, preparation vectors, that aren't in the convex hull of the ones you did, but that would nevertheless still give you a probability between 0 and 1 with all of the different measurements that you actually performed. And then the example I gave was that if the only measurements you performed were Pauli X, Y, and Z measurements, then you would actually be able to have any block vector whose just the only requirement would be that the components are between minus 1 and 1. Because if the only measurements you've done are Pauli measurements, then that is enough to ensure that the probabilities are positive between 0 and 1 on those measurements.
So a related question about the effect space. The figure you showed about it, there was two figures. There was a sphere, and then there was a gyroscope type of thing. So what does the sphere represent?
So the effect space is four-dimensional. So it's just hard to draw a picture of it. And those two pictures were just picking three dimensions and just only showing what's happening in those three dimensions. And in the picture where you had a sphere, those three directions were like the X, Pauli Y, and Pauli Z directions. Whereas in the picture where it looked more like a cone, we were ignoring, say, the Y direction, but we were including the trace direction. Okay, so the thing right at the top is identity, the thing right at the bottom is zero, and then the things around the middle are projective measurements that have trace one.
How about the state space? You assume that it's normalized so that you only have a sphere.
Yeah, for the state space, there's no real need to show the fourth dimension because all that happens is you just have your state space and then you have like subnormalized versions of that as you go down towards zero. So for the state space, all of the information is in three dimensions.
It's a bit of an open-ended question, but I'm just wondering what would you do if you're in the opposite situation where you're convinced that your experiment is actually showing a gap between state space and the measurement dual, and you now you want to convince all the skeptics that this is going to be distinct from what you'd expect from quantum theory, that it's not that I'm just missing measurements. I mean, if I saw a tetrahedron inside this box, I'd be like, oh, go back to the lab and do non-stabilizer preparations and measurements. But okay, you do some of that, and you find, no, I'm still within this structure. What do you do to then say, I can convince you that I can't get outside of this? This is really describing this particular system.
I mean, it's kind of a tough question, right? Because it's like, how do you prove something is impossible if it's logically consistent with the data you have? How can you prove that it's impossible? I think the only way you would be able to do it would be to invoke some other theoretical principles, right? So maybe if like along the lines Lucien was talking about, there were some principles that you were willing to adopt, then you could show that, well, under those principles, there's no way to fill out this thing, and this gap must really exist. But if you just want to stick with this framework,
it suggests that, as you said, there are things that look, I could write down formally, looking like states that give probabilities when measured with my measurements, but they don't seem to be accessible to me in the lab or something. So it's, I don't know if there's a way you can sort of say, what would they be like? And then maybe there's a symmetry argument or something that rules them out, or?
Yeah, so a symmetry would be an example of using some theoretical principle to rule them out.
Yes.
So I have this question of, like, in higher dimensions, you could think of your technique as a way of, like, experimentally inferring the geometry of state spaces in quantum systems. I mean, like, so it's difficult to sort of visualize these state spaces, like, three dimensions or higher dimensions.
Yeah, I mean,
I was wondering if you can think of this as saying, oh, we'll do an experiment to figure out what the state space looks like.
Yes, I think that idea.
Does it scale more?
So I think that idea is, you know, logically correct. You could do that. The difficulty with performing an experiment to, you know, fully map out a, you know, a 10 qubit space is that there are going to be a lot of states and a lot of measurements that you'll have to perform. So yeah, every time you increase the dimension, if you want to, you know, kind of get the same type of coverage of the state space that we got here, it's going
to
take a lot longer.
For a cube trick, for example.
Sorry?
I mean, the same analysis would work for a cube trick, like, if you were, you could use the same principles to infer the state space for a cube.
Yeah, exactly. So all of the analysis and everything would be identical, it's just the experiment would take a lot longer. Yeah.
How do you handle the case where you think you've done a preparation, you do a measurement, but there's no outcome? I would imagine then you'd have like a subnormalized state, but then you would have some information in the extra dimension state space.
Yeah, so experimentally it's difficult to record, you know, no photon events. So the way that we performed our measurements, you know, we had the two output ports from the beam splitter, and, you know, each output port corresponded to either outcome 0 or outcome 1. And then the way that we, you know, inferred the probabilities of each measurement outcome is we just looked at the ratio of those two counts. So our analysis didn't take these, you know, no photon events into account.
But you have a Herald, right? I feel like you should be able to, like, sometimes surely you get a Herald click and then you lose the other photon.
Yeah, so that would happen sometimes.
Can you just put that loss into the effect, or should that be taken into account?
I think you could take it into account, and we would have reconstructed it. You know, if we had done that, I think what we would have ended up with is a, you know, a block sphere that, as you said, is smaller than the one that we had, and an effect space that, you know, I guess it would have to be, well, maybe it would be smaller as well, and then that would increase the gap between the state and the dual effect space.
So sort of continuing on that line of questioning, it seems to me that you wouldn't have seen anything different in your experiment if you had a classical wave there, which is in a different, very different space than the polarized photon. So I'm just wondering if there's any possible signs in your experiment of that. What are we really learning about, I guess?
So I think if we were to do this experiment with classical light, I mean, we're still characterizing the space of polarization states of light. So, you know, maybe we'd be interpreting our results as the Poincaré sphere instead of the Bloch sphere, which is, you know, of course, the same. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
I mean, I don't know much about classical light, but I think you know you wouldn't have the property that you only ever detect on one port of the beam splitter or the other, and it's kind of built in right from the start of this analysis that you have these mutually exclusive events that you're doing a measurement to determine which one applies. So until you have that kind of structure of you know a discrete set of outcomes that you only ever get one outcome. you can't even do the analysis.
So it's analogous to the answer to his question. Like, if you have more outcomes, you have two clicks at both detectors at the output of the beam splitter, you could have no clicks, and then you'd have to take those into account as in your state space.
Yeah, you could try that. I'm not sure what you'd get.
Can I just add something, which is, Jeff, in principle, there do exist measurements that could tell you exactly what the polarization state of your classical light is. Mm-hmm. So if you were doing a sufficiently large set of measurements and you started doing those measurements which allow you to distinguish, they'd be very different from quantum theory, because of course in quantum mechanics I can't tell you exactly where you are. So the question is, to what extent did the experiment we actually do start probing measurements that would tell us that these polarization states are distinguishable? And although we didn't really aim to do that, I think we wouldn't have got such a good rank 4 fit if we'd been using classical light. We would have started to see that some of our measurements can really tell more about the polarization of your freedom than...
Well, it depends on how you set up your experiment, but if you use classical light in your experiment and you only have one outcome, like if you'd set it up so that you only look at the clicks, like the photons get through the polarizer at the end, right? Yeah. Then you wouldn't see anything different, right? Than what you see. Yeah. So it's with the same signals. But I don't know, maybe you didn't set it up with that.
Kevin, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
I think it's great. You have more loss, and you turn the power of the laser way down, you would see similar, the same statistics. So I'm not quite sure what the answer is. But valid description of the polarization of these single photon component, which is basically what you're projecting out of a weak coherent state. So it doesn't invalidate anything. It's a different quantum state of light that we think of as classical. But if you try to model everything classically, then you almost want to change the measurements that you do. You'd have to really measure the amplitude of the field. You'd have a continuous range of values. You wouldn't have discrete zeros and ones. So it really depends exactly
how far you want
to take things classically.
The real state space of the classical polarization is a simplex with an infinite number of vertices corresponding to the infinite number of different polarizations. So if your experiment doesn't reconstruct that infinite vertex simplex, it means you haven't done enough measurements to see that that's the state space. So that's what you ought to get in the case of classical light.
Sorry, how are you distinguishing that from Poincaré, like for the qubit state space, which is also...
The qubit state space is not a simplex with an infinite number of vertices. So it should be not rank 4 for classical light. It should be rank infinity and the shape of a simplex, which is very different from a four-dimensional sphere, three-dimensional sphere. Are there questions? Great. Okay, well, let's... Before we're going to thank them just a moment, but let me remind you that we're reconvening at 11 for Lorenzo Procopio's talk, and now we're going to take a pop break downstairs. So let's thank Matt and Mike.